Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 149 of CJ Evolution, that's Criminal Justice Evolution. I'm Pat Fitzgibbons, host and creator of the show. Whatever you're doing, wherever you're at, thank you for tuning in. Special thanks to all the first responders out there and everybody else working in the criminal justice field, protecting us day in and day out. We would not have this country if it wasn't for you. So thank you so much for your support. I'm very excited to have Jeffrey Higgins on the show today. He is a retired special agent with the DEA. And in this show, we talk about a variety of important topics, such as his role in the DEA and what he did when he was serving in that capacity, what he was doing and where he was at on 9/11. We talk about Afghanistan. We talk about some of the issues facing law enforcement today and his thoughts on all that. Just a great conversation with a great American. So I give you the one, the only, Jeffrey Higgins. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Very excited to have my next guest on, Jeffrey James Higgins. Is a retired DEA supervisory special agent. He's got over 25 years of law enforcement experience, and he is an expert in narco-terrorism. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here, Jeffrey. I imagine you're pretty busy, and you have so much experience. What made you get into law enforcement in the first place?
Well, I think I kind of backed into it. You know, a lot of the police officers I worked with over the years always had wanted to do this, you know, when they were children. And I always knew I was going to be a writer. That was my thing. My grandfather was a writer. I always knew I'd grow up writing. And I became a reporter. You know, I had my undergraduate degree was in journalism. And I started working as a reporter, covered a lot of the police beat, enjoyed what police were doing, thought it was a fascinating field. And then I was between positions, and I was waiting for a reporter's job to be funded that I'd been offered. And I saw this ad in the paper for a private investigator. I was like, you know, that would be great fodder for a book down the road. So I went and I became a private investigator for a year. And while I was doing that, I was surrounded by all these, you know, law enforcement types who really wanted to like work in this field. And I just became enamored by it, you know, the excitement of it. And uh-huh. I remember I ended up reading a book. It was a James Mills book. It was the Underground Empire. And it was about DEA, which is where I eventually ended up, and talking about their international investigations and things. And it got me pretty excited. So I sort of took a left turn and figured I'd do it for a while. And I ended up going down to Tampa, Florida, and I joined the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office, which was a really good organization. I worked down there for about 5 years, you know, doing everything from patrol to street crimes to narcotics detective. It was a good journey, and then ended up with a DEA in New York.
Wow. And that's, I mean, to start off with an interest in journalism, and that's kind of like just polar opposite of where you ended up, like you said. I mean, that's just amazing. I mean,
yeah.
Now you have a lot of experience in narco-terrorism. For those listeners out there, I mean, I know what it means, but for those listeners out there who don't know what that means, can you tell us what it is, Jeffrey?
Sure. Well, basically, terrorism describes a nexus between drug trafficking and terrorism, mm-hmm. on a very basic level. And I've broken it down into four basic types of narco-terrorism so people can really fill definition. And this is where you have drug trafficking groups that are killing police, you know, and intimidating judges, kidnapping lawyers, basically using acts as a way to further their drug trafficking business. So these are people who are motivated by money and they're only engaged in bar, you know, the Medellin Hotel in Colombia. That was sort of the classic example. And then after 9/11, that changed, and DEA really started looking at a new definition of terrorism. And I was actually very involved in that period from 9/11 on. Mm-hmm. And after 9/11, DEA started looking at terrorist groups, you know, like you know, of all different ideologies, but terror groups that were basically getting involved in drug trafficking as a way to finance their terrorism. Mm-hmm. So essentially, they were drug trafficking, but they were still ideologically motivated. The only reason they were doing it was because they had operations they had to fund. You know, it's expensive to have an international terror group. Mm-hmm. And so they engaged in that. And then the third type is a little bit, it's not as common, but basically it's a group where you have a group that's ideologically motivated. They're a terror group, like think like an Islamic terrorist cell, mm-hmm. but they're also equally interested and motivated by their drug groups. And they're like the FARC in Colombia, you know, that's a drug business, but it's also ideologically, you know, it's a Marxist organization that's motivated by a political ideology as well. And in fact, the very first narco-terrorist case that was ever done, the first conviction, was a guy who was equally a drug trafficker and a terrorist. And I'm writing a book about him right now. His name was Han Mohammed. And then just the fourth kind is really the most common type of narco-terrorism. And it's expressed in sort of the symbiotic relationship that you have between terrorists and traffickers. So terrorists are terrorists and they're doing their ideologically motivated activities. Drug traffickers are there making money, but they mutually support each other. Mm-hmm. You know, like in places like Afghanistan, where the majority of the world's heroin comes out of, you see a very close relationship between the terrorist groups and the drug traffickers, where the traffickers, logistically support the terrorists. They provide funding for the terrorists. Mm-hmm. They both share the same weapons traffickers. You know, they're very closely aligned in exchange for the money that they're getting. The Taliban, the Haqqani network, these other groups that are over there will protect the drug labs. They'll protect the traffickers. They'll intimidate the local population and sort of make no-go zones for police. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a mutually beneficial relationship. So that's really the most common form of narco-terrorism.
Yeah, I was talking to my wife, and you hit it, Jeff, about most of the world's heroin comes from Afghanistan. A lot of people don't know that. I mean, that a large majority of the world's heroin comes from Afghanistan. I mean, it's just amazing. But I wanted to ask you another thing. I mean, we have this war, quote, war on drugs. I mean, are we making an impact? And maybe that's a huge question that takes more time than we have. But I mean, you know, for me personally, I mean, and a lot of other people, I think we hear about, you know, all the problems with the cartels and all the drug problems we have. But are we making an impact as a nation? Or maybe you can answer it, maybe you can't. But what's your take on that?
I'll give you an answer. I don't know how satisfying it'll be for you. It's very difficult to prove a negative. You know, so you can look at various metrics. You want to say is the war on drugs, and I really don't even like that term so much. But are making drugs illegal?
Are we having an impact?
Criminalizing them? Is it working? Mm-hmm. And so you know, you can. How do you measure that? So you can look at things like, you know, are drug prices going up or are they going down? Because the market tends, you know, is based on scarcity. And if there's enough drugs out there, then, you know, of course, if the more drugs there are, the lower the price comes. And a lot of times we see that where prices don't really go down. You can look at accessibility, you know, how easy it is for someone on the streets to get drugs. And so these are things you can measure, but they don't really tell the whole story. Like with the drug prices, you might see like a heroin price dipping, but that could be because law enforcement's being ineffective, but it could also be because they're growing more poppies, you know, if there's more product. So it's a very difficult question to answer. I'm actually very sympathetic to some of the libertarian arguments about not having paternalistic laws and about not, you know, criminalizing drug use and having the government say out what people do in their own homes. I mean, having said that, I think it's morally a very bad decision for people. It's bad for their lives. As drugs are horribly dangerous. You know, I mean, it's terrible. But is the fact that the government's making it illegal and getting in helping or hurting? And I mean, my master's was in criminal justice research, so I spent a lot of time, you know, researching these kinds of issues. And there's certainly a lot of unintended outcomes that come from making a drug illegal. You know, there's putting people in jail for like nonviolent crimes tends to break their pro-social bonds and makes it, you know, it basically pushes them from society and makes them more likely to engage in future criminal behavior. You know, so there are things that as a society aren't good for us that we do because we criminalize things, but the drugs themselves are incredibly dangerous, you know? And what I like to say, let me give you a short answer since I just kind of circled around it. Okay. I think that there is a philosophical argument to be made for legalizing some or a lot of drugs, but I think what law enforcement doing is highly effective, because I can tell you from, you know, 25 years in law enforcement, when I put somebody in jail, it was because they were part of like a violent drug group. Mm-hmm. And taking a violent person off of the streets and putting them in jail means that other people aren't getting hurt. And as a theory of justice and capacitation through incarceration is the most effective way to prevent further crime. So, you know, maybe we're not ending the drug problem. And that's probably not even a fair question. You know, it's like saying, you know, should we have homicide cops because they're still homicide? You know, you're never going to get away from people wanting to have drugs, but maybe you are just maintaining a level that's acceptable for society, too. So, I mean, there's some interesting questions there.
Where do you think we're going with the drug issue? I mean, we've already legalized marijuana. Now, I granted it's not as hard, obviously, as like heroin or other drugs out there. I mean, do you think eventually we're going to get to a point where we're legalizing heroin or cocaine or other. I mean, you even said, I mean, there's a philosophical argument behind that. Do you think we'll get to that point, Jeffrey, or do you think it's going to be after we're gone? what's your take on that?
You know, it's funny. I just had this conversation with a sitting U.S. senator, and I don't want to mention his name. and I talked to him a little bit about this. And one of the things I said was, you know, if you have these unintended outcomes, and if you're talking about if you're saying what in general is better for society, you have to measure everything, right? And you have to measure your effectiveness, and you have to measure what happens, and what are the costs of your inputs versus the outputs that you get. And so there's a way to measure this. I don't think you'll ever see like broad legalization, and the reason I say that is because you need politicians to change legislation. And I'm, by the way, I'm not advocating it either completely.
But
even if it was the right way to go, even if we could show, like, scientifically through quasi-experimental designs in various states that are doing legalizations and test projects and things, even if we could show, wow, this looks like we'll be better off with it, you would need politicians to go in front of their constituents and say, I'm going to legalize, you know, heroin. I'm going to go legalize cocaine.
Probably wouldn't go over well with the majority of people, I
imagine. No, it won't. And a lot of times people conflate, you know, the morality of doing something versus whether it should be legal or not. You know, like, I could say that, you know, probably smoking marijuana is not a good life choice for you. It's probably not a good idea. You know, anything to excess, of course, is not a good idea. But, you know, whether the government should come in and prevent you from doing that, that's a separate question. You know, so the answer to one thing might be no, and to the other, it might be yes.
Interesting. Now, I know, Jeffrey, you were one of the first rescuers, shifting gears a little bit, to arrive at the World Trade Center after it collapsed on 9/11. You worked on the New York City Police Department's Joint Terrorism Task Force and in the Department of Homeland Security's Operation Center. I mean, you were at ground zero. And I know you probably talked about this before, but can you talk about what you did on that horrific scene and what you observed?
Sure. You know, I actually haven't talked about it that much because it's such a dark subject.
Sure.
You know, I think people generally don't like talking about it. But I was in New York as a DEA agent working domestic, international criminal groups, but working out of the DEA office, which was off the West Side Highway, just a couple miles north of the World Trade Center. And when the attacks happened, I was at home and I called my office, said, what are we doing? You know, and nobody knew what was going on. So I got in my car and I just drove there. Like, by the way, this is what police officers do, right? This is what law enforcement all over the world does. When people are running from something, they go towards it.
Exactly.
So I went down there, and I remember I was coming down the West Side Highway and I heard a radio call from an NYPD detective saying, the tower, it's gone. Yeah, I'll never forget that call. And I came around the bend, I mean, doing like 100 miles an hour, you know, with no traffic, by the way. There wasn't a lot of people going downtown in New York. Mm-hmm. And there was only one tower standing, you know, just a horrific sight with thousands of people streaming up the sides of the road by the river trying to, you know, fleeing. It looked like a Godzilla movie. It was horrible. So, yeah, I went to the office and a bunch of agents who were there were waiting for some direction. None came. So a bunch of us went down together and we just went down and we hooked up with some of the leadership in the various police departments that had responded to the scene. But it was when we got down there, the second tower fell. So it was just, you know, pandemonium. So myself and a police officer from the NYPD and a Suffolk County detective linked up and kind of in the dust, you could barely see. And the three of us walked down there. So we're actually the first people to get to the North Tower after it came down.
Oh,
and it's just, you know, I mean, everyone's seen the images and stuff, but there on the ground, there were balls of fire, you know, shooting out of the ground, these crevices in the ground from all the fires. There were cars burning, you know, there were bodies all over the place. It was just a horrific scene. And it was a big moment because it was transformational, you know, not just for our country, but also for DEA.
Yeah.
That was really the inciting incident that made DEA start looking at what they were doing. And for me personally, it changed the direction of my career completely. After that, I did nothing or tried to do nothing but terrorism for the rest of my career.
Jeez. Well, thank you, Jeffrey, for your service. Hopefully you get told that a lot. And thank you for what you did on 9/11. I mean, we still have significant threats to the United States. You know that. And a lot of people out there do. Hopefully everybody does. How do you think we can help mitigate those threats? And maybe that's too big of a question to, you know, I mean, but there's so many. It just seems like every time you turn around, there's some other threat out there. And maybe it's always been that way, but am I wrong? Or is it, how do we mitigate those? Or how do we kind of solve some of those threats? I mean, I know some of it comes with diplomacy, but what's your take on that?
Well, you know, to answer like the question you had in the or the statement you had in the middle there, I think, and I read something about this a year or two ago, but I think we're about as safe as people have ever been in the history of the world. And you know, when you look at the media, social networking, when you look at the accessibility to information, every little thing that happens, everybody knows about instantly. And if you're on Twitter all the time, it's just, you know, constant doom and gloom. I think in general, like if you want to talk about the history of humanity, you know, you don't have hordes of barbarians riding horses through your village, killing and raping. You know, I mean, in general, I think we're a lot safer. But there's some very serious existential threats to this country right now. And mm-hmm. you know, my wife is Cynthia Farahat, and she's an expert in Islamic jurisprudence. And she always says, I'm saying something she says, so I want to give her credit for it. But she basically said it's important for Americans to understand the ideology of Islam once those ideas flew into our buildings. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's obviously Islamic terrorism is not the only form of terrorism out there, but it's certainly the biggest threat that we're facing right now. And I think the way we've approached it, it's interesting. You know, I kind of call it the Paris Hilton syndrome, like when people in this country are very well off, you know, our poorest people are better off than the average people in a lot of other countries in the world. You know, if you look at poverty indexes, we're doing so much better. Sometimes it's hard to understand what's happening in different parts of the world. But, you know, looking at like, you know, if you read the Quran and the Hadith and the Sirah, they're very clear. You know, a fundamental Islam is about, it's an intolerant religion. It's an expansionist theopolitical ideology that's about conquest. And I'm not saying that. You know, imams are saying that, people who are actually following fundamental Islam. Now, there's, you know, hundreds of millions of Muslims around the world who believe in a peaceful form of Islam. Sure. You know, there's people who want it to be, you know, compatible with modernity. There's people who don't believe in Sharia law. But there's also hundreds of millions of them who believe in this fundamental Islam. So it's very important, I think, to actually clarify what the problem is that's motivating these people in these countries. Because it's not just, you know, lone wolf radical people who are following this ideology. It's nation states that have codified this into law. You know, there are many countries in the world that use Sharia law, and Sharia law is incompatible. It's antithetical to Western values. It's completely incompatible with liberalism. You know, so it's important to point these things out. And when I got a kick out of, I think it was about a year ago, I remember the media was talking about how ISIS has perverted, you know, Islam, and how what they're doing is not Islam. In fact, it is. They are following fundamentalism, and they had to put out a video in an actual report explaining why what they were doing was based in theology. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think the answer to that, like on the political front, you talked about diplomacy. The answer to that is let's help, you know, the many millions of Muslims who want to practice a religion. Practice it peacefully.
Peacefully, I agree with that. I mean, I think, and I hope a lot of people out there realize that the majority of Muslims out there are peaceful. They just want to live in peace. They want to. They're not doing anything wrong. But yeah, I mean, it's still. I mean, what do you think about North Korea? I mean, what do you think about what's going on? What's your take on that, Jeffrey? I mean, do you think? What do you think is going to happen there? Because every time I turn on the news, I'm like, oh my God, there's this rhetoric going back and forth, and I'm just waiting for something to happen.
Well, you know, let me give you an analogy. I think like North Korea, it's like the little gang member, the 12-year-old kid in the neighborhood who keeps telling you he's going to kill you, you know, and he starts off by kicking you in the shins and running away. Then the next day he throws a rock through your window. Then he starts to get older. Now he's got a stick, you know, like at some point, North Korea will become dangerous enough where it could literally destroy our way of life. You know, you can do an EMP burst that knocks out our electronics. You can do a dirty bomb on Wall Street. These are things that have catastrophic effects on our country, and we're vulnerable. Our infrastructure is vulnerable. So I think the way we got here, it comes out of like the Cold War. You know, it comes out of this two superpowers, two nuclear powers who realize they can't go to war because it'll be the end of everybody if they do, right? So that created over decades this mindset that the goals of war are not total victory, which they always had been for the history of the world, right? The war meant your enemy was trying to kill you, so you destroyed him so he knew he lost, and then you found peace and you moved on. We got away from that to this point where we were looking for a stalemate, you know? And we weren't even looking to do it ourselves. We were looking to use proxies. You know, we were looking to get ground forces from other people because it was easier for us to use them than our own troops. And what we did is we got away from this. And you can see it all over the world. You can see it from, you know, Vietnam, and you can see it in what we did in Afghanistan when we first went in there. There's a reason why Osama bin Laden got away. You know, we weren't using our own boots on the ground. And so I think just from like a big kind of strategic point of view, what we need to do is get back to this. There are countries out there that want to destroy us, like Iran, like North Korea. You know, these are places that we have to take them seriously. And when there's a country that says they want to destroy you, you don't screw around with them long enough for them to be able to do it. And if you look at like North Korea and how we capitulated to them, how we appeased them, and now we're dealing with a nuclear problem. The same thing's happening with the Iran deal.
Exactly.
You know, that non-treaty, you know, was I think the worst deal I saw in foreign policy in my lifetime in this country. But we cannot let Iran get to that point.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you worked a lot with the DEA in Afghanistan, Jeffrey. Can you talk a little bit about your experiences? You mentioned, you know, Afghanistan is one of the biggest suppliers of opium in the world. What were your experiences over there? Working in that country.
That was interesting. When I first went over, we had just opened up the Kabul country office. So DEA had a small office with a couple of temporary guys, and then myself and John O'Rourke became the country attaché, and I was the assistant country attaché. And we brought, you know, a few people in at a time to augment us. And basically, it was like the Wild West when we first got there. But my goal was trying to prove the linkage between terrorism and narcotics, because this was early in 2004 when I went. I was still fighting with intelligence agencies and the military and people who refused to acknowledge that there was any connection between these two things whatsoever, yeah. Which now is kind of shocking. But at the time, so every case we opened up had a, you know, an Al-Qaeda recruiter involved, or had a Taliban seller, a Haqqani network group. I mean, literally, like every case, people would say, well, that's anecdotal. And we say, well, it just makes sense. You know, theoretically, of course, they're going to go where the money is. And I mean, I was in Afghanistan, I think 4 or 5 days, and one of the agents that I was working with had found a Higgs cell that was there. These were affiliated with the Taliban, and he set up a buy where one of our sources was trying to get an IED from this terror cell that had just killed a bunch of Germans at the airport in Kabul. And we got a coalition force together, like a quick reaction force, to come in and make the arrest once our guy was in position. And we missed the guy. The QRF got stuck on the other side of the river in downtown Kabul, and my partner and I were and a couple other guys were following this bomb maker, the suicide bomber, carrying an IED with him, and we knew we were going to lose him, and he was about getting ready to board a bus. So my partner and I jumped out of the car. My partner tackled the guy, and we jumped on top of him and fought him on the streets for it was 21 or 22 minutes it took us before the QRF could get to us, and we had a crowd of hundreds of people throwing bottles and rocks at us, and the IED was sitting right next to us, and while we were fighting him, he was trying to get to the detonator, which was in his pocket, to blow the thing up.
Geez.
So I was there like 4 days, you know. I'm like, oh, so this will be my 1 year tour in Afghanistan. It's a little interest, but it was good. We trained the police and things, and then DEA in early 2005 formed the FAST teams, the Foreign Advisory Support Teams, which are basically DEA's foreign tactical teams, which gave us the ability to work with special forces and gave us the ability to work in countries around the world. And, you know, we had belt-fed machine guns and grenade launchers, and it gave us the ability to work in these austere environments. So I worked with the Kabul country office for about a year and a half, and then I was with our foreign tactical teams in Afghanistan for usually 6 months a year. And I did that for about 5 years, where we were doing like air assaults into the mountains, into these drug labs, and building cases against these transnational criminal groups and terror groups, targeting, you know, drug trafficking, terrorism, targeting corruption within the government. So, as you mentioned, it's sort of the breadbasket of the world for heroin. There's some, every year it changes depending on, you know, the distribution and poppy production and everything, but there's 70 to 90% of the world's heroin that's coming out of Afghanistan. And it's also in Southwest Asia. It's the highest concentration of terror groups in the world. You know, so you've got, you've just got dozens of these terrorist organizations and all this incredible amount of money coming out of there. So it's, it just makes sense that there'd be this natural relationship between the two.
Well, and it, when you were talking about the connection between, you know, the drugs and the war, it made me think about Vietnam, because as you know, like you even mentioned, you know, the, there was a connection, or the, so to say, there was a connection between the Vietnam War and the drug trade.
Sure. I mean, listen, if you, and I did an op-ed in the Washington Times maybe 6 months ago about kind of this very thing, basically saying, put aside the discussion of whether drugs should be legal or not. As long as they are illegal, that means that there's going to be violence associated with them. And if that's domestically, you're talking about gangs. Internationally, you're talking about terrorist groups. But when something's illegal, it takes an illegal enterprise to run it. And those illegal enterprises don't have the cover or the safety of a judicial system to protect them. So they can only do it through their own use of force. So, you know, because these things are illegal, they're going to bring the terror groups and the gangs, you know, into their organizations. And the money is incredible. Like when I was there, we did two cases I'm proud of, really, a bunch of them, but two of them I'm really proud of. One was the case against Khan Mohammed. He became the first ever narco-terrorist. And I just finished a book about it, which is being shopped now. So hopefully we'll have some good news soon. But you know, he was the first narco-terrorism conviction, first guy to be arrested and first guy to go to trial and be convicted. And then we did another case against Haji Bacho. And a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, there was a CNN declassified episode called Haji Bacho, Heroin's Godfather, about this case. And Haji Bacho himself, this one guy that we arrested, one guy in eastern Afghanistan in the Nangarhar province, was responsible for 19.7% of the world's heroin.
Wow.
Just the guy you've probably never heard of, but literally the most prolific drug trafficker in the history of the world. And we had the ledgers, you know, that was the number we could prove. And the 19.7% is based on UNODC worldwide heroin estimates. But the money's just staggering. That one guy, one guy in one 12-month period distributed $261 million worth of heroin at the Afghan kilo prices.
Oh my God.
Yeah. The actual prices when they reach the users, or when they even reach the other wholesalers, you're talking the billions of dollars, like in excess of $5 billion, you know, to come here. And, let me just give you an idea of what the money's like. If you in Afghanistan at the time, you buy, and now it's a little higher, but say anywhere between $2,500 to $5,000 for 1 kilo of heroin. In this country, that 1 kilo of heroin is going to go for like $70,000 to $100,000.
Wow.
So, and that's at the wholesale price, right? When you're selling to like big drug organizations, you can't take that kilo and take some of it out and put it in your arm because the purity is too high. So they have to dilute it usually about 17 times. And so when you go from the actual initial kilo of heroin that like reaches New York, for example, by the time it gets into somebody's arm, it's worth $1.5 million.
Jeez.
I mean, they're just staggering numbers. You're talking, you know, billions of dollars. So the last, I think it was a 2017 UNODC Drugs and Crime report, the most recent one that I saw, estimated that the Taliban was getting up to 50% of their money from drug trafficking. And they estimated their drug trafficking, or their total income, at $400 million. So, you know, roughly up to 200 million they thought was coming from drugs. I think that number could actually be quite low.
It's hard to combat something when that amount of money is involved.
Yeah, I mean, it's here's the thing, is it's really corrupting. You know, you asked like, what are these threats and what can we do about them? Well, one of the big threats, like overseas, is terrorism, obviously, but drugs themselves have this horrible corrupting influence on governments. You know, when you're talking about, especially like a poor country like Afghanistan, but it's any country in the world, when you're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, and the profit margins are just insane. You know, you spend $3,000 for a kilo and it's worth $1.5 million, you know, when it gets to the user. You know, that money can buy a lot of things. And, you know, luckily, most law enforcement officers and prosecutors are honest, and, you know, judges are good people, but they're always going to be that fringe element that aren't, you know. So when you have that kind of like illicit industry, it grows organized crime, it supports terrorism, and it also undermines the rule of law in these countries. Yeah. And when you don't have a strong rule of law, countries are unstable. And when they're unstable, that's when you get even more terrorism and more crime. So by focusing on the narco-terrorism, I think that's something we can really do to make a difference.
Now, what are you kind of shifting back to this country, Jeffrey? What do you believe? You know, law enforcement, as you know, I mean, face just so many challenges. I'm talking about U.S. law enforcement. What do you think some of the biggest challenges law enforcement faces in the United States?
Well, I mean, domestically, there are a lot of issues, right? And I mean, I think philosophically within our justice system, there's this movement where our government's becoming more statist. You know, our government is getting into people's lives deeper and deeper all the time. And of course, police have the burden then of enforcing the legislation. And so, you know, police in some ways have to become the bad guys to enforce these laws. So I think that's a problem. There's, you know, increased criminalization. There's the way we're crafting legislation now. And there's, I mean, we could probably talk about one of them, but there's a lot of ways where you see this, like in insider trading, and you see this in some technical laws where sometimes it's not even clear what's illegal until it actually goes to court, you know, and that's very harmful for the rule of law. You know, we're seeing over incarceration. We're seeing lots of problems with asset seizures. Yeah, yeah. Those are sort of big problems. I'll tell you the biggest one. I think the biggest challenge facing police domestically is fighting the cultural war. And by that, I mean the less war on police. You know, there's been, you know, I don't want to attribute a motivation to it, but when you hear people talking about revolution and overthrowing a paternalistic capitalist society, you know, I don't know what they're trying to do, but police have clearly become the target. Mm-hmm. And you saw it through the last election cycle. Yeah. And, you know, and as an example, I'll pitch this. I wrote an article for Law Enforcement Today maybe a couple months ago, and it was called End the Myth, and you can find it on my website, jeffreyjameshiggins.com. But basically, the myth that there's this epidemic of racist police going around shooting unarmed black men. You heard that from Obama. You yeah. heard it from Hillary Clinton. You've heard it from the DNC. You've heard it from Black Lives Matter. And it's simply not true. And if, you know, I go into it kind of deeply in this article. But if you want, I'll give you the argument. I don't know if you want to get that deep into it.
No, that's fine. Go ahead. I think I told you before when we went on air, I had Heather McDonald on, New York Times bestseller, that wrote a book called The War on Cops, and she talked about this very issue. So,
yeah, it's important. And here's the thing: is the numbers don't lie. You know, so listen. If one cop kills one person because of racism or one person, that's wrong, and the police officer needs to go to jail, and exactly. We all need to rise up and fight it, right? But that's one thing. It's another thing to say that there's this epidemic of racist police, and you hear it all the time, that there's this institutionalized racism in the justice system, and it's actually a floating accusation, because sometimes it's, oh, they're out there killing, you know, innocent unarmed black men, and then it's, oh, well, the way they're enforcing the laws has an inherent, you know, bias to it. And so, like, what they're actually saying changes, but the thing you heard over and over and over again was about unarmed black men being killed. So in 2016, just give you a couple quick numbers, because it's all about the numbers. Police killed 963 people in 2016. 17 of them were unarmed black men. If you look at as a statistical problem, how big that is, like, by the way, I've looked at each and every one of those cases, and the vast majority of them are, on the face of it, justified shootings. So just because someone's unarmed doesn't mean they shouldn't be shot, right?
Oh, exactly.
There's a gun in every contact with police. Police have the gun. There's people who are being, you know, attacks in progress. So, but let's just, for the sake of argument, say that all 17 of those were bad shootings. There's no evidence that they were racially based, right? So if you want to talk about the motivations of somebody, you should have some evidence to back that up. But there's over 750,000 law enforcement officers in the United States. So if you take that, that's over 44,000 police officers for every one unarmed black man who was shot and killed. You know, that, so I'm not trying to minimize if it's a bad shooting. I'm trying to show just how small compared to how many police are.
Oh, exactly.
Like, if you look at the arrests, there were over 635,000 arrests in 2016. Excuse me, 635,000 arrests for every black man that was killed. You know, so if you want to say there's this epidemic, If you have 635,000 arrests where that didn't happen, and then you have one where it did, you still need to look at it to make sure that it's legal, but it doesn't mean that it's an epidemic. Yeah. So basically, you know, in my article, I just showed that the numbers of unarmed black males who were killed, even assuming they were all bad, which most of those shootings were not, it's statistically a small number compared to the number of contacts with police, the number of police officers there are, and the number of arrests that are made. And the claim is that racism is the cause of it, yet there's no evidence to show racism. And what people, when they talk about this like endemic problem, what they talk about is blacks comprising about 13.3%, this is in 2016, of the country, yet they were 24% of those killed by police. So people go, therefore there must be racism, right? But it's as a researcher, because that was my master's, I'm offended by that, because you have to look for other confounding variables. You know, homicide rates are correlated heavily with ice cream sales, but you know that doesn't prove causation. Yeah. It has to do with something like the heat and the people outside in close proximity to each other. So when you look at other confounding variables, there's so many of them. But some of the ones you could look at right away are blacks in 2016 made up 26% of the arrests. They were over half of the arrests for murder. Over 32% of the arrests for aggravated assault, and over 40% of the arrests for weapons possession.
Yeah.
And one of the things across all races, you know, this isn't about race. So across all races, young men are the people who commit most of the violent crime, right? That's true in all the countries in the world. And the median age for blacks in this country was 31 compared to 41 for whites. Yeah. So also, you know, you look at like higher crime rates in cities that tend to have disproportionate amounts of blacks compared to the national averages, you know, so there's a lot of things you can look at that could possibly explain it other than racism. And what you need to do is actually analyze that stuff. But understanding that, you know, in a country as big as ours, having 17 questionable shootings is still bad if they're bad, but it's not an epidemic.
Well, and the thing that, and you even said, that there's questionable shootings out there, and we both probably know, Jeffrey, that there have been some bad shootings out there involving police officers and African-American males. That doesn't mean that it's, like you said, it's an epidemic, that everybody's painted with the same brush. And I'll be the first, being in law enforcement, to condemn a bad shooting out there, no matter if you're black, white, or whatever, saying that officer needs to be punished. But it just amazes me how there's, like you said, now there's, quote, an epidemic out there. And like you said, the research doesn't support that. So I don't know why people keep, you know, lapping this up, drinking the Kool-Aid, thinking that the cops are just out there. So let me, I always tell people, so let me get this straight. You mean to tell me that an officer, any law enforcement officer, gets dressed, they kiss their wife goodbye, they have a nice house, they have a nice life, and they're going to go and purposely go out there and hunt somebody down and kill them? Really? They're going to throw that all away to go out there? And it's not like, but it's just absurd the way some of these people think that we're just out there hunting people down. It's ridiculous. Are there bad cops? Of course there are. But they are the very, 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 very small minority of law enforcement officers.
You know, I think, well, you're right. I agree with you. And, you know, I speak out all the time when I see bad shootings. You know, I regularly analyze these shootings when they come out. And you're right. There are bad shootings and there are bad cops. And some of the cops are racist.
Yeah, exactly.
But you have to have evidence to show that. You know, you can't just say, oh, there was this disparate number of people that were arrested or shot, therefore racism. That's not how statistics work. And I don't know if you've probably seen the study, but there's a Harvard professor, Roland Fryer Jr., who did compared shootings in various circumstances and came up with the conclusion, to his surprise, that there was no significant difference in these fatal shootings based on race. Yeah. You know, so I mean, the science is there. And I think you sometimes say, why do people keep drinking the Kool-Aid? I mean, I think when you look at some of the people who are pushing this and you look at how they're trying to radically transform our society, the best way to do that when you're trying to topple a society is to go after the face of that society, right? The police are the people who bring law and order. Yeah. If you can demonize the police, you can start to unravel society, because when people don't trust the police, society starts to come apart. Mm-hmm. You have to have the rule of law to have to feel safe in your home.
Yeah.
So I think it's more of a political motivation, but right. clearly. So let me just, on a personal note, I had a friend of mine who argued this stuff with me for the longest time, and I kept telling him facts, and he wouldn't listen. And I said, you know what, fine, I'm going to write an article about it. So I crunched all the numbers, this article I was talking about, I publish it, and I post it. And his response was, sad face. You know, like it's clearly an emotional reaction to this stuff.
Exactly.
But like a willful blindness to not see what's really happening.
And like you said, Jeffrey, I mean, is there racism out there? Of course there is. And it's sad and it's horrible. But there is, unfortunately. But that does not mean that every law enforcement out there, and I've had these discussions too with some people on my show, and I respect their opinion. They have their right to their opinion. But I don't believe for a minute that every law enforcement officer is a racist. that are out there just killing people indiscriminately because of the color of their skin or what they believe in. I do not believe that. Like you said, the research doesn't support it. But it is a challenge, like you said, when we started talking about this. It is a huge challenge that law enforcement faces in this country. So,
yeah, I think it's a. I saw something the other day, and this is the first time I've seen it, but I've been waiting for it, where someone was talking about recruitment being down. And I can tell you right now, if you want to go into law enforcement, you look at, wow, I'm going to go risk my life, and suddenly it's not this honorable profession, if I listen to the media, right? It's not this honorable profession. It's people who are abusing their power. It's racist. I don't want to be part of that, right? Before, it was a noble calling to protect the tribe, right? I wanted to protect my people. And now, when you take that away, you're going to lose people. But also, you're going to lose people just common sense. I'm going to go into law enforcement now, and if I shoot to save my life or someone else's life, or God forbid I make a mistake, now I'm going to go to jail for the rest of my life for just trying to risk my life to do my job. Mm-hmm. And so you're starting to see it, and watch. If this doesn't change, watch what happens over the next 5 years when good people stop wanting to become police officers. Yeah, and that's the end of a society.
And we're seeing it now. I mean, in my department, and like you said, departments around the country, I think you're seeing low numbers of people. I mean, it used to be, Jeffrey, and you've probably seen this when you were local law enforcement or even on the federal level, you know, where you'd have just tons of people, you know, responding to, you know, a police officer position. We don't have that. Mm-hmm. We don't have that anymore. Now, I'm not saying it's because we're talking, you know, the reason is, you know, what we're talking about, but I imagine it is a factor. You know, people don't want the liability. They don't want the bad press. If, like you said, if they make a mistake. So it's really going to be interesting, you know, to see what happens in the future with, I mean, I think we'll always have law enforcement. We have to, like you said. But I think it's going to be interesting to see how it pans out in the future and what kind of candidates and what kind of people are getting into law enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, it really is an important thing. And I think the solution to this is for people to speak out. I think it's to have – I love transparency in police departments, by the way. When the body cameras first came out, I had a lot of concerns, especially about issues with privacy. And but now, just because of the situation that we're in, I love them, you know, because the camera gives you – yeah, it gives you pretty – it's protection for the police officer. Yeah. He can show you what he saw, you know. And if you made a mistake, he made a mistake. But at least – and it doesn't show you everything, but it's better than nothing, you know. And so I think transparency, and I think people speaking out and not being afraid to speak out. Like when you come out, especially when you talk about race, I mean, this is a third rail, right? To talk about race is a very difficult thing in this country, but it's important, especially when people are perpetuating myths in very harmful things that aren't true. You have to step up and say, I don't agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Now, another question I have for you. You talked about you worked in the DEA for years. I know the opiate crisis or concern, I mean, it's huge in the United States. President Trump came out with something recently about the opiate crisis. What are your thoughts on that, how to tackle this huge problem? I mean, and you've probably been, you know, I mean, you've probably known it's been a problem for years, but now it's on the forefront. You know, now everybody is freaking out about this, rightfully so. What are your thoughts about this being in the DEA for many years, Jeffrey?
Yeah, it's a complicated problem, and you're right. Today, President Trump came out and called it a public health emergency, and he's getting criticism because there were a couple different avenues how he could have declared it an emergency, but basically what he did is allows funding and grants to be federal grants and things to get to the states quicker. So, you know, it's a huge health emergency, absolutely. You know, and by the way, when we talk about, like, DEA talks about, like, the opioid crisis, but they're talking about opiates, right? Opium, morphine, heroin. But they're also talking about the opioids, which are synthetic opiates. So the most common one everyone's heard of is fentanyl, which is, you know, it's a legal drug, which is, it's an analgesic. So it's used for pain control. It's used in anesthesia. It's made here in this country. It's made, a lot of it's made in China. And it's a really strong, it basically mimics what heroin does, only it's about 50 times more potent than heroin, 100 times more potent than morphine. So it's really dangerous. And it's actually become a big issue for police officers because it is so toxic that if you have enough fentanyl to be on the head of a pin, it can be fatal, and it can be inhaled. You can get it through your skin, you know. So it's an incredible, at least small amount can be fatal. So it's a public health emergency in a lot of different ways, and there's a lot of issues with it, because one of the things that happened, and I think I have an unpopular view on this, but you have it being made illicit fentanyl in analogs. An analog is basically where they, you know, change a couple of molecules so it's a slightly different but has a similar effect. A lot of that's being made in China, you know, and gets shipped directly here. And since it's a legal drug, people have been able to order stuff that isn't legal and have it just sent to their business or sent, you know, is you can just mail it to the country. And a lot of it's coming in through Mexico, through the Caribbean, through Canada. And then when it's coming into those places in bulk and it's brought into this country, and the tooling, the machinery that's needed to like turn it into pills and stuff is very, it's easy to get. It's all over the market. So, and you get the same profit margins that you have with like heroin that we talked about in Afghanistan. It's still about $3,000 for like a kilo of fentanyl. And when that gets into people's arms, it's worth $1.5 million. So there's a lot there. The problem with fentanyl, as opposed to like heroin, is it does have medical uses, right? So it's actually a drug that's used. So it's when we talk about the opioid crisis, and DEA kind of wraps it all into one, what they're talking about are people who are like misusing prescriptions. You know, there are opioids that are in pills that doctors prescribe. You know, you have a surgery, you might go home with five or six pills or something, you know, and it's people misusing that and getting hooked on it. And there were 12.5 million, I think. Yeah, 12.5 million people in 2015 that misused their prescription opioids. That's a pretty big number. And what we're seeing is they're calling it an epidemic because the numbers are just skyrocketing. Yeah. Like in 2013, there were just over 1,000 people who died from fentanyl, and in 2016, that number was over 28,000. Right, so that's over 28 times the number of people in just 3 years. So it is an epidemic in a lot of ways, and the overdose deaths right now, and this is kind of interesting, are actually the number one cause of death from injury. So it's people who die. There's 140 a day now or something like that, but it's There was over 52,000 people who died from overdose deaths of drugs in 2015. And in comparison, it was only 37,000, a little over 37,000 people who died from car crashes. So it's really a dangerous thing.
It's so amazing. And I think of, you know, when I became, you know, a cop, and when I was, you know, got in law enforcement 21 years ago, I mean, it's so much has changed. And what has changed is we're carrying Naloxone or Narcan now. And I mean, it's just amazing how, I mean, for the sole purpose of trying to revive somebody, and I mean, you know what Narcan is, Jeff, and but now
I carried it when I was a DEA. Yeah.
Now we're carrying it now, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but it's just, you know, to your point, where it's just such an epidemic now, where we've used it plenty of times, as a lot of agencies out there have deployed, and that's great, but I never thought we would be at a point in law enforcement where we're carrying these drugs. I mean, maybe you did. I never thought we would be carrying these, you know, this Naloxone or Narcan to reverse an overdose. It's just amazing to me. And it just, you know, it just wonders. I just wonder what we're going to be dealing with in the future.
Yeah, no, it's difficult. And when you talk about like legalization of drugs and things, that's the big unknown, right? Like, say tomorrow we legalized all drugs, so you get the violence out of it, right? What happens? Do we suddenly have a nation of addicts? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There are other countries that have done it on some levels. They're small, like it's with the new marijuana legalization in various states. We have these kind of like quasi-experimental designs we can draw up. But nothing really exactly matches. So it's kind of an unknown for people. And anyone who thinks they have the answer to that, I think, is wrong. There's the philosophical argument that you just don't believe in paternalistic laws, that the government has no right. And if you're going to do something harmful to yourself, which this drug use is, then maybe that's your right. But that's different than about effectiveness, right? Yeah. And the problem with fentanyl and some of these analogs is there's a law, there's an analog law, right, that basically says – What happens is someone comes up with a drug, we outlaw it, then they go into the lab and they switch a couple molecules around, and it basically has the same effect, but now it's no longer that original drug, so technically it's no longer illegal. So what they did was they came up with an analog law saying if it's basically if it has a similar chemical structure, and it similarly affects your nervous system, then we're going to say it's illegal. And I understand it's a really well-intentioned law. It's trying to catch up with really bad traffickers who are spewing poison and killing people, right? So it's a really well-intentioned law to a very difficult problem, these analogs. But my problem with it is when you talk about like making a drug illegal, you're talking about a specific drug. You're saying this substance is illegal, you can't have it. And the analog law says, you know what, if it's close, we don't know exactly how close, and you know when we're going to find out? When we arrest you and we go before a judge and a jury, and then we'll figure out if it was illegal. So like I kind of have a problem with the law, you know, in general, but I understand why it's there. And, you know, and while I'm criticizing, I'll just do one more. I don't know if you saw, there's a 60 Minutes episode this week, and it talked about the big DEA controversy with the pharmaceutical industry and basically.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
Yeah, it was cronyism and lobbying and trying to prevent DEA from going after pharmaceuticals. It's like DEA's diversion program where you have like bad doctors and you have these pill mills where people come in and they're just handing out like opioids like candy, right? And so what DEA has done is they've been trying to hold the pharmaceutical companies responsible. If they see a company that, say, orders, you know, 10,000 pills a year, suddenly that's 200,000, they should know something's wrong at that suspicious and they shouldn't fill the order and they should contact DEA. And, you know, I think it's important to draw the distinction between what's legal and what's moral, you know. So you're talking about a philosophical, you know, you're talking about a pharmaceutical company that's selling a legal substance to somebody who's licensed by DEA to get it. And now DEA is saying, well, you have to see that it's suspicious and not comply, or else we're going to hold you criminally responsible. And so it is. And, you know, in the extreme cases, you can say, oh, of course they knew. So they're complicit in some way. But there's also, it's not their job to be law enforcement, you know, and how are they supposed to tell, and how much are they supposed to cut their business? So these aren't like really black and white issues. And I know because these drugs are so bad and there's so many people dying from it, it becomes a very emotional issue. But sometimes it's important to step back before take some of these actions and look at what are the long-term consequences of those actions.
And that sounds like they're just looking for a scapegoat when things go south and say, look, it's their fault. It's the DEA's fault that, you know what I mean? They need somebody to blame when things go south. So I don't know.
Law enforcement always gets blamed. The problem is law enforcement is trying to just enforce the laws that your legislature puts together, and they can only do as good a job as the legislature does. So in the end, I think your best answer is education. I think there's always going to be people who want drugs, and what you need to do is try to make people understand that their only filter for reality is their brain. Yeah. And the more that they impede their ability to think critically and to reason, the more they impede their ability to live and survive. Nice. And so these drugs are terrible, but people have to make their decisions not to use them.
James, I know you're retired DEA supervisory special agent. What are you up to now? I mean, what's some other – you mentioned maybe inking a book. And what other stuff are you up to now? Because you have so much to offer, my friend. I mean, you're just amazing experience. What are you up to now?
Well, thanks, Patrick. I appreciate that. I just finished my first book. The working title is The Narco-Terrorist, and I'm hoping to have a contract with a publisher pretty soon. And it's basically about DEA's entry into the global war on terror, you know, how a bunch of DEA agents got into the business of chasing terrorists. And it follows the first case, the Han Mohammed case, which was the first narco-terrorism case. But I'm also writing a lot of articles. You know, I've had some stuff recently in American Thinker and American Conservative and Law Enforcement Today. And I mentioned the CNN declassified episode about the Haji Bacho case that was just out. So I'm doing a little bit of media. But if people are interested, they can find the articles. I have a whole bunch of I just hit one of my deadlines for this book. So now I'm going to be writing a lot more articles. They can go to jeffreyjameshiggins.com, and I'm posting my media and articles there.
And you are a part of the Law Enforcement Roundtable, which is a great show for those of you who are interested, and you're a contributor to that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's right. Yeah, Leo Roundtable. It's a YouTube channel, and they do a terrific job. They get law enforcement professionals and people with just an incredible amount of experience. And every week they go through some of the top stories in law enforcement. And one of the things that they do is they go through videos. So there's a live show every Monday at 7 p.m. And then throughout the week, each day, there's a short episode, usually like about 15 minutes, which is released with videos of the police shootings and things that we're analyzing. So if you're interested in law enforcement, it's certainly a nice podcast.
Well, Jeffrey Higgins, thank you so much, sir, not only for coming on the show, but your service to this great country. And thank you. We wish you the best of luck in the future. You are always welcome back. We talked about your upcoming book. I'd love to have you back to talk about that when that's published.
I'd love to come back. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, Jeffrey. Have a good night.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.